Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. At the end of an official visit to South Korea, a top independent rights expert urged on Monday that the country take the regional lead in ending violence against civilians in Myanmar. UN Special Rapporteur Tom Andrews, who reports to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, said that many people in Myanmar continue to oppose the military since it staged a coup in February 2021. Hundreds of protesters died during initial clashes with the military, which continues to hold 54 million people hostage, Mr. Andrews added. Among his recommendations, the UN independent expert called on Seoul to denounce fraudulent elections that the junta is planning next year. The special rapporteur, who is not a UN official, also urged South Korea to impose sanctions on key economic targets associated with the junta. Moreover, he asked South Korea to extend its generous humanitarian visa program, which allows Myanmar nationals to find work, by ruling that all persons from Myanmar residing in South Korea, including irregular migrants, can regularize their status to avoid exploitation and abuse. A key scientific mission is underway, led by the UN Health Agency, to track and update what we know about global health threats, including Disease X. The UN World Health Organization, or WHO, said on Monday that the task will involve updating its list of priority pathogens, ones that cause outbreaks or pandemics, so that investment and research into vaccines, tests, and treatments can be agreed among nations. More than 300 scientists worldwide will look into data on 25 virus families and bacteria, as well as Disease X, which according to WHO is an unknown pathogen that could cause a serious international epidemic. The UN Health Agency published its first list of priority pathogens in 2017. It includes diseases like COVID-19, Ebola and Marburg virus, Lassa fever, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS, Nipah, and Zika. Patents, trademarks, and designs reached record levels in 2021, with Asia driving growth in intellectual property, UN agency WIPO said on Monday. The World Intellectual Property Organization indicated that this bucked the trend from previous economic downturns and came despite the disruption of the coronavirus pandemic. Data published in WIPO's latest report indicated that innovators filed 3.4 million patent applications globally last year. This was up 3.6% from 2020, with Asia driving more than two-thirds of requests. China showed strong growth in local patent filings, up by 5.5%, along with India, also up 5.5%, and South Korea, up 2.5%. In the United States, patent filings dropped by 1.2%, in Japan by 1.7%, and in Germany by 3.9% last year. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Cairo, Egypt. In Colorado, the gunman suspected of shooting and killing five people Saturday night at Club Q, an LGBTQ plus nightclub in Colorado Springs, has been indicted for murder and hate crimes. Officials have identified the five victims as Daniel Davis Aston, a 28-year-old trans man who moved from Tulsa, Oklahoma 2 years ago and worked as a bartender and entertainer at Club Q. Kelly Loving, a 40-year-old trans woman who had recently moved to Denver and whose sister described her as loving, caring, and sweet. 38-year-old Derek Rumpf, a Club Q bartender whose mother described as a kind, loving person who had a heart of gold. 35-year-old Ashley Paw, who leaves behind an 11-year-old daughter devastated by the loss of her mother. And 22-year-old Raymond Green Vance. Richard Fierro, a retired military veteran, has been identified as the person who confronted and disarmed the shooter. Fierro was at Club Q to watch a drag show with his wife, his daughter, and Raymond Green Vance, who was his daughter's boyfriend.
I want those five families to know that's all I care about. I want those that are in the hospital right now to get better. Please get better. We went out to see a show and had a good time. And thank God Raymond was smiling and dancing with my kid. and my daughter got to spend the last day with them.
Richard Fierro was deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan four times and said in an interview with the New York Times, the experience still haunts him. He left the Army in 2013 due to the brutal psychological and physical toll of war and said he never thought he'd experience the same violence at home. In Pennsylvania, immigrant rights advocates welcomed a second bus of asylum seekers to Philadelphia Monday morning, sent by Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Abbott says Texas has bused a total of over 13,000 asylum seekers to sanctuary cities, including Washington, D.C. and New York. Since Abbott was reelected in November, he's intensified his hate speech against immigrants, recently comparing the arrival of thousands of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border to an invasion. It's the same term used repeatedly by the white supremacist gunman charged with killing 23 people at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas in 2019, the deadliest attack on the Latinx community in modern U.S. history. The CEO of one of Ukraine's largest power companies has asked people to stock up on warm clothing and blankets, warning Russia's assault on Ukraine's power grid will lead to rolling blackouts throughout the winter. On Monday, the World Health Organization's regional director for Europe, Dr. Hans Kluge, said Ukraine now faces its darkest days of the war so far.
This winter will be life-threatening for millions of people in Ukraine. Half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure is either damaged or destroyed. This is already having knock-on effects on the health system and on the people's health. Put simply, this winter will be about survival.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris met with Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. in Manila Monday, where she vowed the U.S. would expand its military presence in the Philippines. Her meeting comes amidst growing tensions between the U.S. and China over the status of Taiwan, and as China and the Philippines square off over disputed islands in the South China Sea.
An armed attack on the Philippines' armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft in the South China Sea would invoke U.S. mutual defense commitments. And that is an unwavering commitment that we have to the Philippines.
Dozens of protesters gathered near the presidential palace in Manila denouncing Vice President Harris's visit and U.S. intervention in the Philippines.
We also are against the warmongering of the United States for the sake of asserting its hegemony in this part of the world. We don't want our country to be used as a springboard or launching pad of the wars of the United States against China or any other country. We want a peaceful Philippines and a peaceful region.
In Indonesia, the death toll from Monday's powerful earthquake in West Java province has soared to over 260 people. More than 1,000 were injured. Dozens more remain missing as rescuers continue to search for survivors in the rubble of collapsed buildings. Many of the victims are school children. In China, at least 38 people were killed Monday after a fire swept through a two-story factory in central Henan province that housed chemicals and other industrial goods. Local officials said the fire began after welders allowed sparks to fall on cotton fabric, causing it to ignite. According to the Hong Kong-based China Labor Bulletin, an average of 75 Chinese workers died of workplace-related deaths each day in 2020. In more labor news, members of a union representing U.S. freight rail conductors voted to reject a tentative labor contract. It's the fourth and largest of a dozen rail industry unions to reject the agreement brokered by the Biden administration last September. Many of those rejecting the deal said the tentative contract failed to address chronic staffing shortages, long hours, unpredictable schedules. If any of the unions decides to strike, others will honor their picket line, setting up a potential nationwide strike by more than 100,000 workers as soon as December 9th. Jeremy Ferguson, president of the International Association of Sheet, Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, said railroad executives can avert a strike by returning to the table to bargain in good faith.
It was profits above all else. Every quarter, they wanted to lower their operating ratios so they could please Wall Street, and they did not worry about pleasing their employees. I think a day of reckoning is coming, that they are going to have to realize one way or another that they have to treat their employees with respect.
In Alabama, Governor Kay Ivey has issued a sweeping order to pause all executions statewide and ordered a review of Alabama's capital punishment system after a series of botched attempts to deliver lethal injections in at least three executions this year. Just last week, Alabama called off the killing of Kenneth Eugene Smith after officials struggled to establish an IV line for his lethal injection. Alabama canceled another execution in September for the same reason. Meanwhile, in Missouri, a 19-year-old teenager is urging a federal court to allow her to attend her father's execution next week. Corianza Ramey is the daughter of Kevin Johnson, who's scheduled to die by lethal injection November 29th after several attempts to halt his death sentence were denied. A Missouri law bans people under the age of 21 from being present at an execution. In a statement, Ramey said, quote, "If my father were dying in the hospital, I would sit by his bed holding his hand and praying for him until his death, both as a source of support for him and as a support for me as a necessary part of my grieving process and for my peace of mind," she said. Oregon's outgoing governor has pardoned 45,000 people convicted of simple possession of marijuana. Democratic Governor Kate Brown also said Monday she would void more than $14 million in associated fines and fees. Recreational cannabis use has been legal in Oregon since 2016. In a statement, Brown said, quote, "Oregonians should never face housing insecurity, employment barriers, and educational obstacles as a result of doing something that is now completely legal and has been for years," she said. And human rights groups are denouncing the International Soccer Federation, FIFA, for ordering a ban on any display of support for LGBTQ plus rights by players during the World Cup in Qatar. On Monday, FIFA said it would issue yellow cards to any players displaying rainbow-colored armbands in support of the One Love anti-discrimination campaign. The head of Germany's Soccer Association joined players, coaches, and fans in denouncing FIFA's decision.
FIFA has today prohibited a statement in favor of diversity and human rights. These are values to which it commits itself in its own statutes. This is more than frustrating from our point of view, and also an unprecedented event in the history of the World Cup, I believe.
Meanwhile, Iran's national soccer team refused to sing the Iranian national anthem ahead of its opening match against England Monday in a silent gesture of solidarity with anti-government protesters in Iran. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, ABC World News Tonight told viewers what it thought they needed to know. Bolsonaro loses Brazilian election. Leftist former president wins by narrow margin. The victor of Brazil's consequential presidential race has an actual name. It's not leftist former president, or former shoeshine boy, as the New York Times had it, or even savior, as CNN suggested supporters view him. He's a person, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as Lula, a popularly supported former president whose program had and has more to do with helping poor people in Brazil than with securing the kind of extractive, profit-overall, devil-take-the-hindmost international relationships that elite U.S. media applaud. So just get ready, is all we're saying. For a Latin American president taking steps to protect the human life-supporting Amazon, for example, to be presented in the press as a flawed, corrupt self-server who really, if you're a serious person, suggests that uplifting the poor and saving humanity might just be too expensive a proposition. It's hard not to imagine the use that a differently focused press corps might make of Brazil's change of direction. We'll talk about it with Brian Meir of Brazil Wire and Telesource from the South, as well as co-author and editor with Daniel Hunt of Year of Lead, Washington, Wall Street, and the New Imperialism in Brazil. Brian Meir is coming up this week on Counterspin. In the run-up to Brazil's fateful October presidential election, elite U.S. news media coverage was dominated by the theme that Jair Bolsonaro and his supporters, a la Trump, might not accept election results. In the immediate wake of the remarkable victory of much-maligned progressive candidate Lula da Silva, elite U.S. media coverage was dominated by the theme that Jair Bolsonaro and his supporters, a la Trump, might not accept election results. Palpably less interesting to these media is how and why Lula won against multiple odds, including the power of incumbency, a sea storm of targeted misinformation, and the amplified threats of disruption. Those priorities, that focus, represent lost opportunities for U.S. citizens to learn, not a gloss about a savior, but to learn about the deep, complex coalitional work that goes into defeating a neo-fascist at the polls. And that focus will surely shape coverage of what comes next. We're joined now by Brian Meir. He's co-editor at Brazil Wire and correspondent for Telesur's news program From the South, author, co-editor of the book Year of Lead, Washington, Wall Street, and the New Imperialism in Brazil, as well as a freelance writer and producer. He joins us now by phone from Recife. Welcome back to Counterspin, Brian Meir.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Well, I see a number of tells in elite U.S. coverage of Lula's victory. And let's just start with election integrity. So many words like these from the New York Times' Jack Nikas, their guy on this. Brazil election report finds no sign of fraud, yet fuels disbelief. And the story goes, Brazil finds itself in a tricky situation. Security experts say its electronic voting system is reliable, efficient, and like any digital system, not 100% secure. Now politically motivated actors are using that kernel of truth as reason to question the results of a vote in which there is no evidence of fraud. So the current is fraud. There was no fraud, but people think there was fraud. It's a problem how much fraud people think there was. Now, to be clear, there's no evidence of any, but did we mention fraud? You know, I'm thinking that things are going to change going forward, but right now, while declaring it a non-issue, U.S. media have made the predominant topic in the immediate wake of the election the idea that there are a lot of people that think that the election was not legitimate. Now, not that those denialists aren't a story, but, you know, what the heck?
Yeah, it kind of plays into the entire Stop the Steal, which American business elites and, you know, the people like Steve Bannon and other far-right actors, Jason Miller, are trying to export to Brazil, have been exporting. I mean, Bolsonaro started announcing preemptively that there was going to be fraud a year and a half ago. He set up a military commission with cronies in the army to try and do a parallel audit of the election to the work being done by the Brazilian electoral court system, which has been around since 1932. Even though their job was to find fraud, they found no fraud. And then when they finally released the report after the second round election, after a couple days of protests on the street that were financed by wealthy truck company owners and things like that, their report also said there was no evidence of fraud, but there could be in the future, maybe, you know, but there wasn't in this election. So that's all. It's a non-story, as you say. So why do they keep talking about it, you know?
Yeah, and keep it in front of people. Well, let's talk about another thing that is very much hidden in plain sight. This is NBC's Today Show talking about a stunning political comeback in Brazil. Quote, Da Silva was Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010. He is credited with building an extensive social welfare program and helped lift tens of millions into the middle class. But in 2017, he was convicted of corruption and money laundering charges. He spent 19 months in prison, close quote. The next thing from NBC's Today Show is, back here to the NFL, you know, the New York Times called him once imprisoned former President Lula, just sort of matter-of-factly, a person whose history of scandals has divided voters. And at their most expansive discussion of this, the New York Times said, quote, years after he left office, the authorities revealed a vast government kickback scheme that had flourished during his administration. He was convicted on corruption charges and spent 580 days in prison. Last year, the Supreme Court threw out those convictions, ruling that the judge in his cases was biased, though he was never cleared of any wrongdoing, close quote. And they went on to say that the scandal made Lula a flawed candidate. So I would refer listeners for the long version to previous interviews we've done on Lavallato, but for the short version, when I read Lula was in prison and he was never cleared, what do I need to know?
They're just lying. That's what you need to know. He was cleared. And the thing that he was imprisoned over didn't happen while he was president. It was a trumped-up fake charge that he had received a free upgrade to a slightly nicer apartment in a building that his wife had been paying installments for years. It was her purchase. He'd never actually visited the apartment in question. They never came up with any paper trail showing he'd ever received this apartment. But even so, if it had happened, which there's no evidence that it did, it was after he left office, so it was impossible to prove conflict of interest. Money laundering was not a charge that he was ever convicted of. That's just total disinformation. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened is that over the course of the time he was in jail, it was revealed that the prosecution team had been illegally collaborating with agents of a foreign government, the U.S. Department of Justice, using informal communications, bypassing Brazil's sovereignty laws, in which low-level public prosecutors are supposed to channel all of their communications with foreign governments through the Justice Ministry, but they were just talking one-on-one. He had a group of 18 FBI agents meeting with him every 15 days for years, coaching him through how to use different media tactics and things like that to smear Lula. What the Supreme Court ruled was that the case had been illegally forum shopped to a friendly jurisdiction in a state where the alleged crime did not take place, so it was judged out of jurisdiction. The courts also ruled that the evidence that they had presented was tarnished through judicial bias. The only evidence they actually had on Lula to arrest him was one coerced plea bargain testimony from a corrupt businessman who had massive sentence reduction and was allowed to retain millions of dollars in illicit assets in exchange for the story he gave. He changed the story three times before he got out of jail, and the court ruled that that was invalid. And so what it then ruled was that any Lavajato conviction of Lula would have to be reopened, any charges would have to be reopened in the proper jurisdiction in Brasilia. What the New York Times and these other papers are not mentioning is that when all of those charges were attempted to be filed against Lula in Brasilia, in the Brasilia court, they were immediately dismissed by the judge because there was no evidence and ruled that they could never be opened again. So he wasn't just released on a technicality. He's been fully exonerated from every charge related to Lavajato operation. And we know subsequently from the leaked Telegram conversations that Glenn Greenwald initially revealed in The Intercept, a small portion of them, we know that the judge, who was bizarrely allowed to oversee the investigation and the trial, he rejected over 100 defense witnesses for Lula during the trial. He had been collaborating illegally with the prosecutors, coaching them on how to smear Lula and his family, how to deal with the media, and all of these things the entire time. And then immediately after the 2018 presidential election, he illegally leaked information smearing Lula's replacement candidate, Fernando Haddad, on the eve of the election. Immediately after that election, he was awarded a ministry in Jair Bolsonaro's government. There's leaked conversations of the prosecuting team from Lavajato saying they were praying to Jesus that the Workers' Party would lose that election and that Bolsonaro would be elected. He's under investigation for a series of crimes right now, yeah, including, you know, conflict of interest, accepting a cabinet ministry in a government that he helped put in power using illegal tactics. So it's really, it's slanderous to pretend that Lula was convicted and that he just got out on a technicality. That's slander. Like, if someone said that during the election in Brazil, they would be guilty of electoral crime. It was illegal to say he was just arrested on a technicality in Brazil during the election season. Like, even the most hostile media groups, like Global TV, which cheerled for Lava Jato for years, they had to announce on the air that Lula was totally innocent. There was no charges against him. Everything that he'd been accused of was fraudulent, and he was completely free of any kind of involvement of corruption. So the fact that American papers are still repeating this bogus narrative with all kinds of disinformation inserted into it, like money laundering. He was never charged with money laundering or convicted of money laundering or anything. What happened was, during the week that they launched the charges against Lula, in order to justify transferring the case out of its proper jurisdiction into this friendly court run by U.S. Department of Justice asset Sergio Moro in Curitiba, they invented a charge of money laundering related to Petrobras Petroleum Company. 1 week after the case was transferred in 2016, they removed it from the charges. And in Lula's actual conviction, the judge specifically states that there was no money laundering. So they're still repeating this fake narrative from 2016 that was used to justify the illegal forum shopping of the case. It's irresponsible because it's a way of, like, undermining Lula's victory, which is one of the most impressive political comebacks, I think maybe rivaled only by Nelson Mandela, of the last 100 years.
Well, let's start right there, because we have seen sort of matter-of-fact references to an amazing political comeback from Lula, but somehow it's still not yet anyway the center of the story, that comeback, in the way that one can't help but imagine that it would be if Lula were someone that U.S. elites liked. So we read frequent references to fifth grade education, or in the New York Times, Lula is described as a former shoeshine boy. And that all lands very different when we know that they're talking about somebody that they don't like. You know, I mean, ABC News had Bolsonaro loses Brazilian election, leftist former president wins by narrow margin. You know, he doesn't even have a name. And I have to wonder why it's so much more interesting for U.S. corporate media to look at, to talk about a monster, you know, than it is for them to explore coalitional bottom-up work of marginalized people, even when that work is remarkably historically successful.
First of all, it's because none of them would ever want a former labor union leader to become president of the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's pretty obvious, right? Like, I mean, they really downplay the labor union angle here. Not only did he lead wildcat strikes in the late 70s that helped bring down the U.S.-backed neo-fascist military dictatorship that was so beloved to Jair Bolsonaro, but he and the people he was working with in the unions, they created a new kind of labor organization, which academics have created a term to describe it, social movement unionism. The other big union federation they use, besides the CUT, which Lula founded, to describe this phenomenon is COSATU in South Africa during the 80s and 90s. It's a concept of labor unionism in which the union doesn't just fight for wage increases and benefits for its workers. It fights for the betterment of society as a whole, for ending economic injustice as a whole. So, like, they'll fight for raising the minimum wage. They'll go on strike for raising the minimum salary for everyone. That always gets left out of the picture. He's one of the greatest union organizers anywhere in the world of the last 50 or 100 years. I mean, he's a legendary union organizer, but it's better for them to say he's a former shoeshine boy, because that makes it easier for them to label him as a populist and not a social democrat or democratic socialist who's read thousands of books. He has this incredible ability to explain concepts from, like, Marx's Capital in everyday language that poor, illiterate people can understand, concepts like alienation, exploitation, and things like that. They leave that out to make it look like he's just this ignorant person with a lot of charisma.
Yeah, and also that he was simply a backlash candidate. You know, the references that I saw to Lula being able to build a broad coalition the New York Times, I guess it was, said, quote, the strong opposition to Mr. Bolsonaro and his far-right movement was enough to carry Mr. Da Silva back to the presidency, close quote. So it's only being defined negatively and not positively in terms of people voting for something. Now, there was one exception to that in terms of U.S. news media coverage, and that was climate. That was one area where media carved out some space to say, you know, hey, in terms of humanity, Lula is obviously better. And that spurred some of the more humane and better journalism. Jane Ferguson at PBS NewsHour, for example, was one of the few places where you heard actual indigenous people talk about the meaning of the election for them. That, hey, indigenous people have voices. You wouldn't know it from U.S. elite media, but NewsHour had some things. CNN turned the importance of the votes of poor people and particularly indigenous people into the idea that this just killed me, quote, the poor and destitute could become Brazil's kingmakers, close quote.
Great.
I don't even know what to say to that, but it's bizarre, the idea that because people get a vote and that because there are a lot of poor people, somehow poor people are running the show. To me, that's just reporters engaging the shadows on the cave wall, you know, just talking about demographics and not talking about human beings. Finally, on climate, before I ask you, I'm already worried when I see things like Reuters from yesterday, November 16th, saying at COP27, Lula was, quote, greeted like a rock star, close quote. To me, that's already the beginning of a kind of diminishment. He's just about popularity. He can't really do anything. People think of him as a celebrity and not quite a politician. And yet, the point is, climate is one area where media seem willing to acknowledge that Bolsonaro was a problem and Lula is better.
Well, at some point, even the elites have to realize that if they burn down the entire Amazon forest, everyone's going to die, you know?
Yeah.
That's like 20% of the world's oxygen supply. I think Ferris pointed this out in the past in multiple articles. Like the one area that the flak machine or whatever Chomsky and Herman would call it, that
right.
The manufactured consensus allows some kind of breathing room for left opinion is in the environment these days. And you see newspapers like Guardian, which is now more popular in the U.S. than it is in England, I think, they're economically 100% neoliberal. They ran like 35 articles normalizing Jair Bolsonaro in October 2018 between the first and second round elections. And they gave him headline space to compare himself to Winston Churchill and say that the real fascists were the leftists. They're not progressive at all economically, but the thing that makes their reputation as being progressive is that they have this emphasis on environmentalism always, you know? So you see that in the U.S. as well. But I think what really happened here, Janine, is that having a clown in power isn't good for anybody, really, not even for elites. At some point, even U.S. business interests get disturbed by instability generated by this kind of clown in power. And the idea that there could be this kind of like Bill Clinton-style neoliberal candidate that had a chance of taking power from Bolsonaro was just laughable. I mean, the neoliberal parties ended up with 1% and 0% in the first round elections. Like nobody in Brazil buys that we need more austerity and privatization line anymore. It's dead. So the only person capable of beating Bolsonaro at this time was Lula. So they begrudgingly accept Lula's victory, and they have to celebrate his environmental stance, like promising to stop cutting down trees and all of that, which he had a good record on the first time around. But they're going to do everything they can, I think, and I mean elites, but through the media, try and undermine and belittle his presidency so that nobody like him can ever come to power again in the future.
Right.
Because on his acceptance speech, the first thing he said is that I'm going to eliminate hunger. My number one goal of this administration is that every child, every person in Brazil can eat 3 meals a day again, because there's 30 million people passing in hunger right now. And imagine that any precedents around the world of this, he's not even in power yet. He's taking power on January 1st. He's already pushing through a constitutional amendment to remove the neoliberal spending caps on health and education that were pushed through after the coup against Dilma Rousseff in 2017, with a lot of support from the U.S. at that time. I've seen left analysts in the U.S. media saying, well, how is he going to govern? How could he possibly govern? He's already almost got a majority in Congress. He's not even in office yet. I mean, all the stuff they talk about in BBC and in other places about the power of the evangelicals, how the evangelical Christians were going to keep Lula out of office. Bolsonaro's biggest evangelical supporters are now lining up to align with Lula, the leaders of the biggest evangelical churches. They're all switching their game. They're gonna end up siding with him. One thing that people don't understand in the U.S. about countries that have a lot of different political parties and things, there's 23 parties in represented in Congress. Imagine if, like in the U.S., let's say Biden wins the election and 50% of the Republican senators and congressmen switch parties to the Democrats. This is what happens every time someone takes power in Brazil. Half of the opposition politicians switch parties and join up with the person who just took office because they know that the president is in charge of the budget and they all want more money for their jurisdictions, for their districts and stuff like that. So it's always like this. This idea that there would be these huge problems for Lula to govern because the country's so polarized and blah, blah, blah. It's all just melting away now.
Yeah. The razor-thin margin of victory, right? Yeah.
Razor-thin. It was the first time in history since the end of the U.S.-backed military dictatorship that an incumbent has lost re-election. Bolsonaro outspent Lula. In personal donations, he had over 30 times more. There's no corporate donations in Brazil, which really helps the elections stay a lot fairer, you know. Mm-hmm. But from rich individuals, Bolsonaro got 30 times more campaign donations than Lula, mostly from a handful of these big right-wing truck company owners and agribusiness people who are making money cutting down the Amazon. And according to Reuters, you know, which is hardly a sympathetic voice to the Latin American left, even Reuters noted that Bolsonaro had channeled 273 billion reais, that's about $53 billion, of federal funding into his strengthening his reelection campaign. He did that by like artificially lowering gasoline and food prices, by lowering the taxes. He rerouted money from cancer prevention and treatment into lowering gasoline prices. 50% increase on welfare checks that kicked in 2 months before the elections, which cynically, a lot of people thought that was going to throw the election to Bolsonaro. And as it turns out, the poor people didn't change their votes because of that.
I think we are going to see U.S. media compartmentalize Lula's climate efforts and sort of, given their economic views, say, oh, isn't that a pretty idea? Too bad he's not going to be able to do it. That feeds into this whole thing that you're talking about isn't it going to be really tough for him to govern?
They're going to say it's bad for the economy, probably.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, the more honest talk about what Lula means for the U.S. and Latin America, that's probably going to come later. But there is some writing on the wall. There was a New York Times piece titled, What Does Brazil's Election Mean for the United States? And it started with, Bolsonaro made baseless claims about the election, but while Bolsonaro's whole anti-democracy thing was a snag, quote, still, the two countries have found common ground in trade policy, with Washington pushing to accelerate Brazil's bid for membership in the OECD, a 38-member bloc that includes some of the world's largest economies. This process will continue if Bolsonaro is reelected, said this source, a professor at a Brazilian university, but it's not clear if it will be a priority for Lula. Close quote. I think this is starting to tell us what we can maybe expect to hear more from as Lula's presidency goes forward, that, you know, ultimately Bolsonaro was a bad egg, but he did have some geopolitical ideas that align more closely with the U.S.
In fact, he was the biggest bootlicker to the United States government of any president in Brazilian history. So there's a lot of ways they're going to reframe that, I'm sure. There is the new Cold War starting up, already in full swing, obviously. And the fact that Lula is going to refuse to take sides on the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and he's going to maintain good ties with China and refuse to demonize Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, that's going to annoy a lot of people in Washington. But I think for now, the Democrats are just happy that Bolsonaro's gone because of his relationship with Steve Bannon. I think they're going to put up with some of Lula's insistence on maintaining sovereignty and linking up with other Southern Hemisphere governments, you know, South-South collaboration and things like that, because they're just so happy that Steve Bannon and his movement have lost a toehold in the Americas. And I think that U.S. Democrats should study how the Brazilian electoral court system worked and how they defeated these kinds of tactics because it will help them defeat the right. I'm not saying the Democrats aren't right, but, you know, to defeat fascists in the upcoming presidential election in 2 years. I think they could learn from that instead of just, like, labeling people and labeling things and saying what went wrong, what Lula's doing wrong and stuff. Why not stop and look and see what were the tactics that were employed that worked? How is the Lula administration now going to systematically dismantle this fascism? Because it's already crumbling.
We've been speaking with Brian Meir. He's co-editor at Brazil Wire, correspondent at Telesource from the South, author, co-editor of the book Year of Lead. He's been speaking with us from Recife. Thank you so much, Brian Meir, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the National Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
And as a reminder, good afternoon, your host. We have John Grant in the second hour. Here is a short from the United Nations on the COP27 closing session in Egypt.
COP27 concludes with much homework and little time. We need all hands on deck to drive justice and ambition.
When the rest of the world is watching this space, they are really just asking one critical question. Are we making enough progress compared to where we were last year?
The numbers on our NDCs just don't add up. The transparency of commitments from countries, businesses, and institutions will be a priority of the Secretariat.
This is The Lid Is On with me, Conor Lennon, recording the actual last COP27 podcast from New York. Yes, I'm back home. Just got back a few minutes ago. Just said hi to the family. You want to say hi?
Hi.
Hello.
I'll be done as quick as I can. Now, I know I said Lara and I had done the last COP27 podcast on, what was it, Friday. But if you remember, our news was that there was no news. No consensus was reached before the pavilions and food stalls were closed down. But finally, early Sunday morning, this morning, we got an outcome document, and I wasn't there. So here's what happened. I had a flight booked from Sharm el-Sheikh on Saturday evening. I spent the last 24 hours or so in airports or up in the air, checking in on developments as best I could on dodgy Wi-Fi. Anyway, I was following what was happening. Back at Sharm el-Sheikh, I could see photos of exhausted TV crews, journalists dozing on the couches outside the big plenary hall, and I was exchanging texts with colleagues in New York and Sharm el-Sheikh, and everyone was getting more tired and more frustrated. And I have to admit, I held up very little hope that we would get an outcome document, because when I left my hotel in Sharm el-Sheikh on Saturday afternoon, things were not looking good. The COP27 president, Sameh Shoukry, held a press conference, and he looked pretty exhausted and pretty defeated.
Over the last 2 weeks, I have been following closely the consultations and discussions that have been underway between the parties, efforts to reach a consensus, primarily the issue of loss and damage, the mitigation work program, the global goal and adaptation. We have been working through the night, all of yesterday, with all of the negotiating groups to hear from them directly their perspectives, their interests, where they see a landing zone to deal with these issues so that we can find a path forward and move ahead to reconfirm our dedication to the UNFCCC process and our ability to meet the challenges of climate change. The issue now rests with the will of the parties. It is the parties who must rise to the occasion and take upon themselves the responsibility of finding the areas of convergence and moving forward.
Now, as COP27 President Sameh Shoukry essentially saying, I've done my bit, guys, now it's up to you. And there was an NGO press conference not long after that, and pretty much all of the focus, as it has been throughout this COP, was on loss and damage. Here's Li Shuo, Global Policy Advisor for Greenpeace East Asia.
We have worked hard and traveled quite far over the last 2 weeks. We have now come to this critical juncture at COP27. This is a very important moment. The world is watching this space. And I think when the rest of the world is watching this space, they are really just asking one critical question, which is, are we making enough progress compared to where we were last year? If we look at, you know, if we look across the world, what happened this year, the severe climate impacts across the world, we need to show solidarity to the global south, in particular the most vulnerable countries. So the world is watching this space and asking, are we delivering this firm and strong political signal by creating a loss and damage finance fund at this COP?
Li Shuo from Greenpeace East Asia. Other NGO leaders made similar calls for a loss and damage fund. And loss and damage, I think it's going to be the big phrase from this COP, like fossil fuel phase down was for COP26 last year. I mean, we were talking about loss and damage almost every day for the past 2 weeks. A quick recap, if you haven't been following every twist and turn, loss and damage in this context refers to the impact of the man-made climate crisis on developing countries, which tend to suffer the most, whilst bearing little to no responsibility for the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing it. They want a fund set up to compensate them for the devastation wreaked by climate shocks, things like floods, hurricanes, droughts, which sounds fair, right? But it's complicated. For example, which countries should be paying into this fund? Historic emitters like the US and Europe? Or what about rapidly developing countries whose emissions have been rising sharply, such as China or India? And which countries qualify as vulnerable and therefore able to benefit from the fund? Should the fund be linked to emissions reductions, limiting developing countries' ability to improve lives by making use of their gas reserves, for example? Like I said, it's complicated. Anyway, late afternoon, Saturday, local time in Egypt, we started hearing that some kind of overall deal might actually be possible, with language on loss and damage financing, some mention of a fossil fuel phase down, which was introduced at COP26 last year, of course, and that the 1.5 degree target, so keeping global temperatures to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, would be mentioned, because there'd been some worries that even that wouldn't make it into the outcome document. So, those of us who were still around were waiting for that final plenary meeting, which would put the final seal on the whole thing, but it kept getting delayed and delayed, and eventually I had to head off to catch my plane. And in the airport, I was getting texts and emails, the Wi-Fi is going in and out, and then I had to get on the plane. The plenary finally began on Sunday at around 4:30 local time, and by all accounts, it was a pretty tortuous process. And there were celebrations when the section on loss and damage was gavelled through, because it's taken around 3 decades to get it on the agenda. And now the idea of a fund has been agreed, details to be discussed later, but this is big news. I think it has to be taken as the win from this year, given the pessimism that overshadowed the last 2 weeks. In terms of efforts to keep global temperatures to no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, well, 1.5 is in the document, so technically 1.5 is alive, but there's no real detail on how exactly that's going to happen. There's also been some concern from some quarters about the inclusion of the phrase low emissions energy. Some observers are worrying that could be used as a justification for the exploitation of new gas fields, which are less polluting than coal, but they still contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. So after the gavel came down, Simon Steele, the head of UN Climate Change, summed up the achievements.
We've determined a way forward on a decade-long conversation on funding for loss and damage, deliberating over how we address the impacts on communities whose lives and livelihoods have been ruined by the very worst impacts of climate change. So at COP27, we've established the fund that will provide one pillar of the response required to ensure loss and damage is addressed. The IPCC report that came out in April, written and agreed to by the world scientists, told us that global emissions need to start a downward trajectory by 2025. That's only 2 years away. The IPCC also told us to cut emissions by nearly half by 2030. That's only 7 years away. In this text, we have been given reassurances that there is no room for backsliding. It gives the key political signals that indicate the phase down of all fossil fuels is happening. We have set a work plan for 2023 to help articulate the nature and components of a global collective goal on adaptation and resilience and how it can be structured in a way that feeds into the global stocktake. This opens the door for transformative action to achieve climate resilient development. It will help to break the mindset that for decades has kept us from moving beyond business as usual. There is absolutely no point putting ourselves through all that we've just gone through if we're going to participate in an exercise of collective amnesia the moment the cameras move on. The numbers on our NDCs just don't add up. The transparency of commitments from countries, businesses, and institutions will be a priority of the Secretariat.
Simon Steele, the head of UN Climate Change. Also, he mentioned initiatives to encourage the financial industry to move funds to investments that support sustainable development and move them away from the fossil fuel industry. And he promised to keep the pressure on throughout the year and hold nations to account. He said that the UN Secretary General wants UN Climate Change to come up with a plan to ensure accountability and transparency in the process. Well, back on Friday, if you can remember that far back, Lara and I went through the UN and UN-backed initiatives that were launched or announced at this COP. They include efforts to curb greenwashing, in other words, unsubstantiated green claims made by companies and cities. Also, a plan to help vulnerable countries and people get more warning of climate shocks, such as floods or hurricanes, and a new tool that identifies exactly where emissions are being produced. Lara and my UN News colleagues produced the final story on COP earlier today, and all of the detail of the final outcome is there. Just Google UN News COP27 and you will find it. And finally, here's an excerpt from the remarks recorded by the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who came back to COP for the final negotiations. He welcomes the loss and damage progress, but he pointed out that what's really needed is serious action on reducing emissions.
A fund for loss and damage is essential, but it's not an answer if the climate crisis washes a small island state off the map or turns an entire African country to desert. The world still needs a giant leap on climate ambition. The red line we must not cross is the line that takes our planet over the 1.5 degree temperature limit. To have any hope of keeping to 1.5, we need to massively invest in renewables and end our addiction to fossil fuels. We must avoid an energy scramble in which developing countries finish last, as they did in the race for COVID-19 vaccines. Doubling down on fossil fuels is double trouble. That is why I am pushing so hard for a climate solidarity pact. A pact in which all countries make an extra effort to reduce emissions this decade in line with 1.5 degree goal. A pact to mobilize, together with international financial institutions and the private sector, financial and technical support for large emerging economies to accelerate their renewable energy transition. This is essential to keep the 1.5 degree limit within reach and for everyone to play their part. COP27 concludes with much homework and little time. We are already halfway between the Paris Climate Agreement and the 2030 deadline. We need all hands on deck to drive justice and ambition.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at COP27, repeating his call for a climate solidarity pact. He mentioned this at the beginning of COP. which would bring developing and developed countries together to pivot the world towards reducing carbon emissions. You can find that whole video message on the UN News website. Now, that really is it for this COP, but the lid is on. The UN's flagship weekly news podcast will be back on Friday, so please do like and subscribe. Have a great week.
got him on the phone. Quite a bit of news in the first hour. The first hour was a little bit crowded with news, with COP27, the climate action in Egypt, the United Nations having their meeting in Egypt about the environment and climate change. So we added an extra program this first hour. So it was pretty newsy, not a lot of crime jazz for ushering in John Grant. Hey, John.
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay, it's breaking 50 degrees, might be 55 here this afternoon, maybe 60 tomorrow. We've sort of broke out of a really serious cold spell after a week.
Yeah, we've had the same pattern. It was like colder than a well digger's ass yesterday. And today is cold, but it's apparently going to warm up. So I guess that same cycle is kind of heading our way.
Well, I hope
warming.
So. You'll enjoy it.
Right, yeah. So I got the New York Times here. A lot of stuff going on, obviously. We live in interesting times. Craziness keeps going on. Craziness all over the place. So I'm particularly interested in, the shooting in Colorado Springs has become really, really interesting, as is also stories on the suspect in the Pelosi attack, the Mr. Pelosi beaten with a hammer. That story is really interesting, both of them. The Pelosi story is kind of interesting because, Kevin McCarthy, who is delighted now to he is squeezed in as Speaker of the House, what I'm saying. And he famously said, or notoriously said, that he was looking forward to the exchange of the gavel when the Speaker of the House gives the gavel to the new majority when the shift in parties. And Kevin McCarthy said that he's looking forward to that because he was going to receive the mallet from gavel from Pelosi, and then he was going to hit her with it or something. He said something of that order. He did say that. He was joking. He said, yeah, I'm going to, bonk her with it,
Yeah.
Well, she has, I think, very gracefully faded away at a very perfect time for new leadership, so that also she does not have to go through that gavel thing with that stupid fuck Kevin McCarthy. And, she can go home and take care of her husband, who actually was hit on the head with a hammer, so it's just, all kinds of ironies. A very interesting story that, this guy that, broke in. I guess what's interesting is these attackers and these ideological attackers are such losers, It's like, it's an old story, but it's like, pretty amazing, anyway, to me. The hero in Club Q, LBGTQ bar or nightclub, whatever it was, that guy, the guy who ended it all, the major, I think he's a 44-year-old, something like that. He's a major. He's 4 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was there. We think of this as, we straight people think of these clubs as, all homosexuals and perverts and things like that. This is a family. The man brings his family. I think his wife was there, his daughter and daughter's boyfriend. His daughter's boyfriend was one of the dead. And, it's a family outing. That's what's so bizarre about it, watching a friend of theirs was performing a drag show. You know, it's just amazing that the right, is focused on these kinds of places, when really what they are is there's something very gentle and, as they're calling it now, safe places. You know, that bar is a safe place for people, on the marginalized, whether they're gender marginalized, sexual preference or race, I suppose, and things like that. So you get all kinds of people come to these places, and what was interesting is they're now referring to it as a quote safe place, which when you think about it, really says something really strange is going on in this country, where people are focusing on minority gender issues, people with gender issues in a minority. And, anyway, I've talked enough here. What do you think, Mike?
Well, the attack on the bar, first off.
Yeah.
My experience with gay bars is like four blocks down from a clinic I worked at.
Mm-hmm.
There was it appeared to be a lesbian bar, mainly. Or a women's.
Right.
There was a women's bar.
Yeah, probably focused on women in some cases.
There's some tough women in there with motorcycle jackets on and motorcycles.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
But I was always welcome. I'd go down there, and it was I called it a gay bar.
Right.
Because everybody was happy.
Yeah, of course. Exactly. It's a whole double entendre.
And that was a chance. That was in Kansas City, Kansas in the early 90s, in the previous century.
Yes.
And this was in Kansas City, Kansas. Now, what I found interesting, that this night spot, this safe place, or safe space, is located in Colorado Springs, which is if there is a Bible buckle belt in Colorado, it's my understanding, it's located around the Air Force Academy and several big churches in that area. So,
I know the Air Force Academy is notorious for right-wing religious whack job stuff. Yeah,
and the whole community. I mean, if you want to call it a community, it's a city.
Okay.
But I mean, it really is. So it was pretty brave of them to open up a safe space in that area, in my opinion. This isn't Boulder or Denver. And so I thought it was remarkable that...
I think it's remarkable.
Also,
and the story...
One more thing.
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Please,
One more. That's all right, one more thing. And this is the location now in the outer limits, the outer limits of Colorado Springs. There was I think it was 2010, a damn near a suicide attack on an abortion clinic in that area, in that geographical area. And the guy was crazy, and he had bombs and guns, and he killed a couple people, and the police ended up trapping him in a hall, in a room, and then went through the wall with some sort of like a boom, like a construction boom.
Right.
Rammed it through the wall to get him in, to capture him, to go through the hole, the breach, and get the guy and arrest him.
Yeah.
I mean, he was that desperate to kill people. He got trapped by his own. He got trapped in one room. So, I mean, this guy was very determined and nuttier than a fruitcake. So for them to open, or I don't know how long the Q Club has been open, I should look at the article. I've got it in front of me. But, I mean, I could see how in a very repressed community, in an area in Colorado which is not favorable, that you would have people like this combat veteran who was there with his family,
Right.
And I would suspect if I was there, I would have security. Of course, that's what I used to do.
Right.
I would make sure that they had some damn big bouncers.
Well, this guy is his own security.
Yeah. Right. What does that mean? He's an Army major. I mean, that's interesting. And you said,
He's kind of overweight. Almost like, he describes him in here. It's very interesting. I just rewatched with my wife last night. I found an extant copy of it, my film I made in Vietnam in 2001 about a Marine who was shot up, two guys shot, saving his life, and long story. And he decided to go back to Vietnam to get to know the people that we decided to go over there, invade and kill, and so I made a film of it. And it's about a Marine wounded vet who has fed up with war and is just disgusted with the whole process and wants to, encounter and engage with the same people he was at war with, to borrow Freud's terms, in the realm of Eros versus Thanatos, which is the death instinct and, focused on violence and torture and all kinds of horrible things like that, of making change and solving your problems, versus Eros, which is about, it's not always about erotics and sex. That's only certainly one aspect of it, but it's about, dialogue, engaging with people, respecting people, while solving problems by, engaging with people and to meet everybody's needs in some way. Well, Freud and Einstein were trying to figure all that stuff out going into World War II, and they abjectly failed, obviously, because they couldn't get a grip on these impulses. Chris Hedges has written about it in his book War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, a great chapter on Eros and Thanatos. And so what seems to me is, I see this a lot of times in movies nowadays because I've studied this sort of Freudian stuff, that here's a perfect example of that. Somebody who experienced the intense, chaotic, ruthless sort of, craziness of war, where you have to do exactly what this man did when the shit hits the fan. I had an infantry guy, big black dude I knew when I was dealing with vets in prison. He was a friend. He was a minister, and he knew one of the guys in the prison. Big infantry guy, been through the Battle of the Adrang and all this kind of stuff. And he pointed out to me that normal people, infantrymen are not, quote, normal people. In other words, normal people, when somebody comes into a room or starts shooting, they do like the bartender. This guy, a young guy, he says, I ducked under the bar. I just hit under the bar, and I figured, how the fuck am I going to get out of here? Well, our man here, Mr. Fierro, that's not his instinct. He's not a, quote, normal person. He's an infantryman. He's an experienced infantryman. So what is this guy doing without thinking a bit? He can see, he's analyzing the situation, he can see that the guy has shot up the room, everybody's fled and hidden, and he can see that there's a area in the back, sort of a courtyard area, I guess, where people are accumulating, and he could see that the guy's focused and heading that way. So he just jumps up and runs as fast as he can and grabs that son of a bitch by some hook or latch on his armor gear, flings him down, and the rifle is thrown away by the action. This man weighed 300 pounds, the guy that was shooter. The shooter weighed over 300 pounds. And so he knocks him down. He grabs his pistol and starts beating the living shit out of him with the pistol, screaming at him. They're all screaming at each other. And the guy stopped. A dancer, a male, you know, drag dancer in high heels, right, coming by, you know, oh, get out of here. We got to get out of here, you know. And he says, wait, motherfucker, I want you to come here and help me and take your high heels and stomp on this son of a bitch. And that's what happened. And the cops arrived. And, of course, what do the cops do? They slam our hero down on the ground. They put handcuffs in him and throw him in the back of a car before they realized, you know, he's a good guy. You know, so to me, this is the solution. You know what I mean? This is the solution to this craziness of crazy people shooting, that people have to start. There are some people, you know, maybe extraordinary people, experienced people, think like an infantryman. You know, when the shit hits the fan, you are in a firefight. This is a fucking firefight. You know, so this guy is the guy for the moment. He's the guy. He wins the day because he, thanks to the United States invading Iraq and Afghanistan, he has experienced this stuff, you know. But he's decided, he's fed up with war. He says that in the piece. He's fed up with war. And he's here with his family. He's adjusted to the fact is, you know, his daughter has a boyfriend there, and apparently have a friend who's going to be, you know, they're going to watch him do this in drag thing. And it's all wonderful, and everybody's, you know, okay, hey, Joe likes to dress up as a woman. Go for it, dude, you know what I mean? And it's like these people have worked out their problems, you know, and all of a sudden along comes this 22-year-old clown, 200 or 300 pounds, you know, who's had encounters with the police, was going to bomb his mother's house or something, you know. These people have to be focused on and collected, you know. I don't know. You know, it's getting to the point. If this is the way civil war is going to be, you know,
yeah.
In other words, it's all these cynical, power-seeking, hungry Republicans, most of them, sons of bitches, have decided they want power. So they are going to flush out all the frustrated lunatics with AR-15s, you know. Go kill whoever's bothering you. You're upset with homosexuals, you know, because maybe you're a secret homosexual yourself and you have some of those impulses. It scares the hell out of you. So you want to just kill it. You kill it. You kill it. And you go to a gay bar and it solves your problem. You feel better. And, of course, here we are, you know. It's a crazy, crazy dynamic at work here. I don't know. I just get really, really weirded out by all this stuff. You know, and I say I have my guns. I keep them oiled. I shoot them now and then. You know, it's like really is, you know, people who, you know, vets who are fed up with war, you know, in this case, we're glad he was experienced in that and he saved lives. You know, it's like I don't know.
Well,
you know, I'm ranting here, I think.
Mayor, Colorado Springs Mayor John Southers said of Mr. Fierro, he said he saved a lot of lives.
Yeah.
I have never encountered a person who engaged in such heroic actions and was so humble about it. And
he didn't even think about it. That was the thing. Yeah.
Well, I think it's on time. I mean, the guy did it. But what I find amazing is that this guy, who his name is the suspect accused, Anderson Lee Aldrich, age 22,
yeah.
Anderson Lee Aldrich, You know, what I found sort of interesting about his background is that he had changed his name once, and I believe it was him, and his grandfather is an enthusiastic January 6th MAGA MAGA supporter. And
California Republican, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and he lost his seat in the assembly.
Oh, did he? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, in the midterm, just last month. I mean, not even that, November 8th.
So basically, this 300-pound, 22-year-old armed whack job is the grandson of a MAGA Republican congressman who just lost his seat.
Seat, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you
well,
got
wow,
see,
that,
I,
that's a hell of a story.
I got
boy.
That.
That is a hell of a story.
Yeah, I get that. I pick up stuff like that, you know, a lot because I, for instance, look at how people like, Ben Shapiro, who I don't like, his viewpoint at least. I think he's terrible.
Right, he's Republican
now,
asshole, but he's not. He's against Trump now.
He even drew the line on the attack on Pelosi's husband. But I find it extremely amazing that other so-called MAGA comedians, I mean, they made a joke about Pelosi, saying that Pelosi's husband was homosexual. Oh, he said Pelosi's husband was homosexual. He was having a date in his house, he got attacked by a queer, a homosexual.
Evidence whatsoever. Absolutely
no evidence. None of that. And at the same time, you have Elon Musk, one of the richest men in the world, tweeting about freedom of speech, and he includes an article from a notorious conspiracy news site in California that poses as a newspaper, he tweets that and immediately that about free speech and the attack on Pelosi's husband Paul, and then he gets called out on it and he deletes his own tweet, and he's the owner of Twitter. He's the owner,
of course.
He had to withdraw that because of the outrage. He realized the outrage is so outrageous that at every turn, whenever something happens bad like this to people in the opposition, people who I think Elon Musk looks up to, other billionaires and people, I guess, like Joe Rogan, influencers, I think he's so much under the spell. This is one of the richest men in the world, under the spell of this, I don't know what you call it, the culture war shock troops, I guess, for lack of better terms.
He has so much money. He's hit the gravy train to such an extent, historically unprecedented, that the guy has so much goddamn money that it's gone to his head. You know, the same way it's gone to Trump's head. You know, that these are people that. We have to be careful
Musk is like 20 times bigger than Trump on the economic ladder, if not more.
Right.
However, what I find amazing about Musk is that, and the secret, the dirty little secret, the corporate socialist that he is, I mean, he's received so many government subsidies for his battery factory and for his startup on Tesla years ago. I mean, he received so many government subsidies. You can't really call him a self-made millionaire. He inherited millions of dollars from his father, who did many things and just stumbled on emerald mining company that mines emeralds, the jewels. Yeah, and that's where his father raised him in this kind of atmosphere in South Africa, of all places. So I mean, this is the thing that the people like McCarthy joking about getting the mallet from Pelosi.
Yeah.
Steve Bannon. even Donald Trump. They all joke, right. And they have this very thick angle in their humor about attacking the opposition with, in a way that has nothing to do about, you know, their positions or policies. It's all about,
well, you know, like, you know, my theory, my I just wrote something about to somebody, but I'm sort of citing the you know, I like to cite things like, you know, Freud and Thanatos and all this, but also Richard Slotkin's trilogy, Regeneration Through Violence, in the 70s. This whole, he makes a great, the first book, Regeneration Through Violence, a great book. I've read it all, but a lot of it, that he has his thesis is that America, in its exceptionalism and its glory, its self-perceived glory and all this kind of stuff, that, of course, if you look at the history fairly and honestly, you can see that, you know, America's great, quote, genius is violence. You know, it uses violence. When it gets to the point it's having a hard time with somebody, or it's feeling depression, or things aren't going well, you know, the world is internationally interrogating the idea of American exceptionalism. I'm like, wait, what do you think? Your shit doesn't stink? And, you know, people are beginning to ask these questions. Well, when these periodic cycles happen, when these low points happen, Slotkin's argument was that America reaches into its portfolio of tools and finds its genius of violence, and these forces on the right regenerate the wonderfulness of America through the use of violence and the threats of violence and the signs from my asshole neighbor down the road, the roofer, and, you know, big, huge sign, Trump, make liberals cry again. And so this sense of violence is now given permission, you know, in ways, very hypocritical ways, obviously, that, you know, encourages people to employ violence. And it's just an insidious process, and you can see it. And to me, in this area of Thanatos and death wish and instinct and all that, well, torture and sadism, sadism is something we like to sort of make, you know, kind of ridiculous when we emphasize people like the Marquis de Sade and his wacky history. Of course, he was a very right-wing person himself. That the idea of people enjoying their power is manifested in a sense of sadism. The joy you take in overpowering someone else, especially someone you disagree with, you don't like, or whatever. And this process is at work. You know, Schadenfreude, which is the soft version of sadism, where we all do it. We take pleasure in people we don't like, stumbling or tripping on their you-know-what or whatever, you know, embarrassments and all this. We take great joy in this. Well, that's a soft version of the feelings of empowerment one gets by others' misfortune. Well, if you cause that misfortune in others, and that gives you great satisfaction, that's just your garden variety sadism, you know. It's a fundamental instinct and impulse in human beings, and I think that needs to be recognized. The left, you know, it does its share of it, I suppose, but it doesn't do it anywhere to the, you know, insidious nature of the right, you know, these guys taking sort of pleasure in flexing their power. Although, obviously, by doing that, they alienate a lot of people, and they essentially don't come in with the big red wave that they expected to have, you know. So they're basically failing. But in the process of failing, that also excites their violence and their sadism. And, you know, so we get incidents like this Club Q from whack jobs who were, you know, listening to the, these authorities who are sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, encouraging lunatics to go out and shoot things up. You know, it's just a, we've watched it for years now, a couple of years, several years, and, you know, it's like we kind of make excuses for it. We don't really call it for what it is, you know, I mean, what these, you know, Republicans are using violence. And as I say, Richard Slotkin and Regeneration Through Violence as a History of America, he nails it. This is not new. What we're going through is not new. It happens periodically, right. Cyclically. Anyway, yeah. So
well,
we got to deal with it. And this guy, yeah. Our man, Fierro, whatever his first name is an iconic hero of this. He's going to be like, you know, remember Bernie Goetz, the guy that shot those guys in the subway in New York?
He became a public figure.
Why ain't this guy going to become a bit of a public figure on the other side, you know?
Oh, he's already that.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy was unarmed. This guy didn't take a gun.
Right. He's a big guy himself.
Yeah, I mean,
he ran at a 300-pound man with a gun, you know. Amazing.
Yeah. In one interview, I heard him say he saw the guy had a backpack and body armor, and he named the backpack or the armor, and he said, I saw a handle, and I knew I ran there if I could get to the handle. And he did. Evidently, he threw this guy on the floor.
Right.
That's when it all
and
started,
uses fulcrum to fling that guy around into the bar or something, bang his head. You know?
Yeah.
Use all that 300 pounds against him, you know. Oh, yeah.
He didn't think about how he's going to get across the bar. And he was. This gunman was moving towards the outside enclosure. Where all the people.
Right, he wasn't focused on his back. He was focusing forward to go into this courtyard.
Right.
And he could see that as an opportunity, and he took it.
He'd already shot five of these people in the bar, two bartenders, and 15 other people were injured. Right. And he was working his way to where the people were running. I mean, that's a real predator, a guy who is like, I'm focusing on where the large mass of bodies are. So I could kill as many as I can. I mean,
and that's where he was headed to the courtyard, which was packed with people.
And this morning I heard on our local Kansas City, Missouri radio, 710 AM listeners in Kansas, this guy, it was local. It wasn't a network, you know, right-wing station. Right. This guy has 3 hours every morning, shock jock, right-wing shock jock.
Yeah.
And he goes into this long diatribe about how the left is making all this stink about the bar in Colorado, and he claims this guy is totally lost, is out of his mind. This is something I've heard over and over from them. When one of their actors act, that's crazy. He's a bad example. He's not one of us. Okay. And then this is live on Kansas City Radio this morning, and this shock jock is saying things like, and of course they're after the guns again. They're going after the guns again, you know. And
of course
they are. I was shocked to hear how these guys. Now this guy's a media mouthpiece for one of the largest AM radio stations in this corner of the state. And I know everybody's listening to him, okay? And I'm thinking this guy is so misrepresenting, because if he knew how hard, and he doesn't, obviously, but if he ever went to court in high-profile murder trials and realized how hard it is to get an insanity, I'm insane as a defense for killing, he would never use that, because insanity is indefinite in terms of many terms legally. Yeah. It doesn't even exist to a large extent in the law. And this guy is not going to be able to do the "I went crazy." My granddaddy taught me. Taught me to do this. You know, and I went crazy. It's not going to work. It's not going to work for a lot of these.
Right. Well, first of all, the idea of insanity. psychopathy is not, in my view, a mental illness. You're not crazy if you're a psychopath. You have the moral compass of a tiger, you know. That is not a mental illness. That is a human characteristic, you know. Now, somebody can describe it as a mental illness, and that's the world we live in, where, you know, you're either normal or you're fucked up, you know. But I don't see it that way. I see a psychopath as simply, in a way, unburdened by conscience. I don't have a conscience. Hey, why do we want to have him carry all that baggage around, moral baggage, you know? A psychopath is liberated, you know, this is the age where psychopaths sort of rise to the surface in this craziness. You know?
Well, and last night, Mark Levine on right-wing radio, now he is syndicated over the country.
Yeah, he's a piece of work.
He's saying the same thing. He says the same thing, that this guy was just a lone wacko. They become suddenly lone wolves, you know, and crazy at that.
Yeah, but he's a lone wolf that's instigated by people like Mark Levin, you know. Fuck.
Levin, right. That's the part. You know. And I think that's the one thing people miss their opportunity in America to, like, well, just look at what these guys are doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting historical parallel from the early 60s and the early underground left-wing movement, when the left decided, the Weathermen decided to go underground with violence, okay?
Right.
There's a certain parallel with that. I happen to know that many FM radio, rock and roll radio, so-called underground radio stations, would encourage that kind of behavior also. Back then, I mean, the Weathermen carried out over 100 bombings, and nobody was killed. Now, they bombed places like the restrooms or the Congress.
Except
but
where they
still,
set bombs
of
off by accident in their own house and blew themselves up. They
blew themselves up. My point is there's this national lampoon type thing on the left. I look at it like everything from the roundup of the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement, AIM, all these outrageous acts of state violence, state mandated
Leonard
violence,
LTA, all this,
these groups, yeah, all that. I think there's a sort of a national lampoon characteristic to the right wing and how they interpret that, how they interpret those days.
In the realm of truth and power, they're 100% absolute power. They could give a rat's ass about the truth, you know. It's one of my things. What's your lodestar? What floats your boat? What do you search for? What do you work for? Is it on a continuum? Is it truth with a capital T, or is it power with a capital P? And what continuum, proportion, degrees do you have in that those two pursuits, you know? Anyway, that's my shtick, you know.
The right is all about power. It doesn't give a goddamn about the truth,
you know.
Yeah, but the left, what I'm trying to say, I guess, and I'm not doing it very well, the left has been through this shit for over 80, 90, the left has been through this shit for 80, 90 years. Losing,
of
getting
course.
Arrested, throwing bombs, getting arrested.
Yeah.
Killing scabs, getting arrested.
Yeah.
Everything. Anything you can imagine in the name of anti-communism this country has done to what call themselves the left wing in this country, going back to the turn of the last century, World War One. I find these kind of people really chicken shits, and they're not insane, and they are they're reinforced culturally. I mean, by these people. Today's world is amazing in terms of in terms of communication and technology. And these people...
Well, thanks to the internet, social media, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't like they...
life was simple 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Life was simple 30 years ago. We just dealt with life in the real world. Now we deal with life, but we have to deal with it in the internet. Everything is through the internet, and it's mind-boggling. It's, people are so confused, are so overwhelmed, the conscience and all those sorts of things are just lost and trampled, because it's like the expansion of the railroads west. There was nothing that was going to stop that. Morals, ethics, go to hell. The railroads, get the Indians out of the way, fuck them, then let's go. We're just doing it, and that's manifest destiny. Well, we're in another manifest destiny period. And it's the internet and cyber world is sort of thrusting forward with it, It's not a railroad now. It's just the complexity of the internet and control of life itself by all the, artificial intelligence, all this nonsense. And we're stuck in it.
Well,
we don't even understand it. We're stuck in it,
Well, there's a parallel.
And of course, his craziness is on the left. I mean, it was a Bernie Sanders guy who shot Scalise at playing baseball.
Let's get that straight. That guy was old enough to have lived the '60s.
Right.
So, I mean, he may have been a carryover from what's left of the so-called radical extreme wing of the left.
Yeah, you're probably right. He was a bit of an older gentleman, wasn't he?
And I think he decided he was just going to take it on himself and see how many congressional baseball players he could shit. I think there was. I don't know. It's all Republican. That's the last vestige of it. I haven't seen it other than. I haven't really seen that kind of temperance among people, intemperate people in the left in decades.
No, I think his case was an anomaly. It's an anomaly, yeah. It's the right now the right wing is having its 60s, if you will,
There you go.
Yeah, in some ways, it's a similar sort of outburst.
It's their version.
You
get a lot of these. There are a lot of people who cross over who I knew as lefty.
No question.
I know punk rockers, if you can imagine this. People who were punk rockers in the 80s, who are now Republican Catholics. In this century, and I'm sort of like, what the hell, this guy?
Well, that Joe crossover is always the last couple of years been really fascinating to me. We have Tulsi Gabbard now; she's the one I'm focused on. Gabbard is on Fox News all the time now. And by the way, the guy that whacked Mr. Pelosi on the head. His history is pretty fascinating. He was a bit of a whack job, and he had a stability for a while with a woman who liked to, pose and protest naked against the Iraq war. This woman would, she's a beautiful woman, apparently, take off her clothes and, get attention. I remember in front of the White House, three women that took off their clothes, at a demonstration, and boy, everybody's attention was paid to them, because they were rather attractive young ladies, and they were, this is my Bush, not yours. Remember that period?
Well, apparently this guy
was attracted to one of those women who liked to pose naked at anti-Iraq war. And so he, probably to get laid, men will do anything to get laid, this guy was protesting the Iraq war. And for a while, he was on our side protesting the Iraq war because he liked this naked woman. Very exciting for him. You know, my God, look at this woman. You know? And so he then was gravitated. His, quote, radicalization sort of took him to the left, right? Well, now it's drug him to the right. And, you know, it's like, This is what's jaundiced me from a lot of the left, is because, you know, it's like, it's
okay,
all crazy.
Yeah,
it's all crazy. It's all crazy. I mean, some of the people, my friends on the left, you know, they have their heads so far up there, you know what? It's like it's lost. Where the fuck is it up there, man? Jesus Christ. But that's my particular quirks, you know.
Well... But, well, culturally speaking, we must remember this maniac that attacked Paul Pelosi with a hammer is from San Francisco. So I mean, anything.
Yeah,
possible,
well, there you go, San Francisco. God bless him out there. It's crazy. Crazy town. And of course, San Francisco is where a guy can kill the mayor and a councilman and get away with the Twinkie defense. Like, oh man, I just had a lot of sugar and I just went overboard, you know. It's like, I don't know. Why can this guy get a break because he shot a mayor? I don't know. I mean, again, another wacky moment in history. Yeah. In American history, you know.
Have you been to San Francisco? I've only been there a couple times. I spent some time.
Yeah, a couple times. I mean, I like San Francisco. I love the Northwest Coast. I love Oregon, you know, and Portland. And, you know, they have their own, you know, whack job nature. But, you know, and there's racial issues in Portland and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, the right blew up the whole thing about the Portland occupation and during the Trump years, and there was a great picture that I'm very proud that I published it, of this woman. I can't even remember her name. I'm not sure I should use it. Who sat down stark naked in the middle of the street in front of the cops who were shooting rubber bullets and stuff at these protesters. And they all
you get a beautiful woman to take off her clothes, and it's a real showstopper.
and all the cops stop shooting rubber balls.
Yeah, right. Cops suddenly were overcome with a moment of peace. Like, whoa.
I read the whole context, the story around it, and then not only did they do that, but they just said, "Oh, fuck it." They went back inside the. I think they're protecting the federal building from the nonstop demonstrations outside the federal building over immigration. And this woman does this. Splits her legs open, lays down.
She was not shy, that's for sure.
Splaying her legs wide open.
I remember back in the Bush days. Back in the Iraq war with all, you know, all the women, you know, they would have signs. And, you know, one went, you know, this is my Bush, you know, this is his Bush, my Bush, you know, George Bush, my Bush. Oh, God, I tell you, life is amazing.
Well, it is, and times change. I think this guy that went into the gay bar in Colorado Springs,
right,
is an example as a more raw example of how, I mean, who could take AR kind
right.
of, first off, there's a lot of this shock jock on AM radio, 710 AM in Kansas City. He never brought that up. He thought he said they're attacking our guns once again. They're attacking our guns. They're attacking our guns.
Oh, is that all it is?
He never brought up him holding his mother hostage in a standoff with the Colorado Springs cops, and say he had a bomb. His mother called the cops.
Right. He's gonna blow his mom up
for several hours in a standoff. The cops are, in a standoff outside his mother's house,
I saw a picture of him from the back, and he's a monster. The guy weighs 300 pounds, and he's, like, standing for the cops. You know, he has a shirt that looks like a tent, you know, and it's like...
The questionable Daily Mail out of London, Merrill, England, the Daily Mail had pictures of this. And you listeners, you can go there. And there's a whole thing about this guy, Mr. Aldrin.
Well, he should have been naked. He should have been naked. That would have been.
Yeah, he's
300-pound naked man with an AR-15 at a gay bar.
And a bomb. And his mom.
And a bomb. He tried to kill his mother with a bomb. Yeah.
And he's
still walking around in the street, you know.
Weeks, months later, he shows up at a gay bar in Colorado, kills a bunch of people. The shock jock at 7:10 a.m. radio in Kansas City never even touched on that. Never mentioned it. Never did. He just said he's a crazy guy and they're attacking our guns. Again,
that's right. Poor misunderstand man, you know. Yeah, you give him a break. You know, he's just expressing his Second Amendment right. You know, like he's an American.
Right.
God bless
he's
him.
Mentally ill.
And they're just trying to take our guns away. They're maligning this poor man because he has a gun. You know, it's like, come on. Hey, what the fuck are guns for? They're for shooting people, and that's what he was doing. You know, come on.
The Daily Mail out of Merrill, England, London, England, quoted him as saying, as he was coming out of his mom's house, okay, he did not have a bomb, and he was clothed. He did have his clothes on. He says, I'm going to blow the holy hell out of this place.
Yeah.
That's his quote.
I'm damn right.
We need to
clean this fucking place out with
holy
a bomb.
Hell. The holy hell out of this place. They still arrested him. But he somehow criminal history disappeared until he murdered five people. Now suddenly it comes out. That's what gets me about the whole situation in America today is that you could read almost look at all these people and they've all got some sort of background. Hell, I got some background. It goes back like 40 years. I mean, I've been nonviolently clean for about 20 years, you know. But, I mean, you know,
uh-oh.
You go way back in my background.
What
I
about before those 20
flag.
Years?
Hmm. Well, that's what I said. I mean, I've been known to wave a red flag, you know. I never really used any firearms, you know. I'll tell you this: these people are that superficial. I mean, this guy's 22 years old. This guy, the whack job, not so whack job, you know. The guy. I'm wondering if they just want three hots and a cot. I mean, a lot of these
it's probably not quite that simple, but there probably is something to that. You know, the idea that going into some public place and just shooting the hell out of the place and, you know, getting, how cathartic that is to shoot people, you know, if you're feeling low.
I guess.
You know, for certain people like this. Oh God! This is the best way to get out of your depression is just fucking shoot people, you know.
You're sick.
You know, really. I mean, that's got to be. One would think that would be the argument going on in this poor man's head. You know, like, what do I need to do? God, I'm so frustrated. I just need to shoot somebody. I'll feel so much better. You know.
Crazy. Well, see that. You should be on Kansas City local radio. I'll tell you that right now.
I'd love to get on there, you know, and talk shit with people. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that would be a good. That would be a great way to really stirring up the hackles among these people out here.
You really have to. I mean, there's so much bullshit being flown around in this country right now. You know, again, I hark back to my famous. Friend at the, you know, who wrote On Bullshit, Harry Frankfurt, the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Harvard, He wrote that the most salient feature of American culture is there's so much bullshit. Well, it has never been truer than now. You know, it's just we are just awash in bullshit. You know, because, you know, algorithms are bullshit. The crap on the outside of the box, this marketing culture, you know. You know, you got all this shit on the outside of the box that says what's in it when what's inside the box is what's in, you know, the butter that we got, this really low calorie butter, they just did a story on it, you know, because of distribution issues in the economy. They have really lowered the standards of products everywhere in America now because they're having problems. And so this butter, it's gooey. It doesn't taste like it used to, this butter we got. You know, and now I realize why. Because, you know, the crap on the outside of the box gets more exciting, you know, and more this and that. And, you know, but the crap inside the box is getting... It's getting worse. It, you know, they're saving money by putting less good stuff in it, you know? And this is the culture we live in. You know, it's like, you know, as they adulterate the crap in the box, they just go over the top with the marketing crap on the outside of the box, you know? What a country, huh?
Well, and Elon Musk, Donnie Trump back on Twitter. Doesn't matter.
I really feel secure that Elon Musk now controls Twitter. It makes me feel so much better. You know?
John Grant.
Hey,
John
Mike. Grant. Take it easy, man. We'll be right back.